You're listening to the Illustration Hour podcast, an interview podcast where I talk to illustrators, art directors, and agents about the craft and business of illustration. My name is Julia Dufossé, and I'm an editorial and commercial illustrator based in Chicago. And I'm chatting with creatives within the world of illustration to learn about their process, the challenges they faced along the way, and how to succeed as an illustrator today. Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Illustration Hour. Last week, there was no new episode, as you may have noticed. I was sick and had just finished a big commission, but all is well. I'm back to normal now, and this week is just so exciting for me, so I want to get started right away. This week, I'm welcoming a very inspiring and talented creative on the show, Clay Hixon. Clay Hixon, you can find him at Clay Hixon on Instagram or clayhixon.com for his website, is an LA-based illustrator and founder of the independent Risograph Press, Tan and Loose Press, as well as the founder, co-founder, I should say, with his wife, Liana Jeggers, of the monthly newspaper titled The Smudge. Clay is not only a hugely talented illustrator with a distinctive 70s vibe, who's worked with clients like Netflix, American Express, and Apartmento, but he's also a very generous and active member of the illustration community. Shortly after graduating from the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, Clay stumbled across a Craigslist ad for a risograph printer. He took a chance and bought that machine, which, by the way, if you don't know, is a huge monster of a printer. He took a chance, bought that machine, and learned everything about risograph printing. And he started his own independent publishing house and press called Tan and Loose. Since then, Tan and Loose has published books from artists like Lan Truong, Gabriel Alcala, Peter Gamelin, and many more. Clay's other side project, and a hugely influential one that has earned him tons of acclaim within the creative community and beyond, is The Smudge. The Smudge is a monthly newspaper inspired by political journals of the 70s underground scene that Clay publishes with his wife, the illustrator Liana Jeggers. The Smudge originally started after the shocking 2016 election results and the election of Donald Trump. The Smudge aims to provide a forum for artists, writers, and creatives to speak freely and support social movements and causes. Each month, Clay and Liana donate some of the profits from The Smudge to a different organization. So far, they have donated to the ACLU, Earth Justice, the National Immigration Law Center, and many other groups. If you want to help Clay and Liana to keep making The Smudge, and you are interested in helping contribute to some important groups, please consider subscribing for a year of The Smudge. It's only $55 for a year, and it's really an amazing project. You'll get to see amazing illustration by very talented illustrators. The link to that, to subscribe to The Smudge, it will be in the show notes for this episode. So, what do we talk about in this conversation? Well, there's tons of great stuff. We talk about Clay's path, how he became an illustrator, how the harsh Canadian winters encouraged Clay to start drawing more, why Clay insists on doing so many things besides his commission work, and how he approaches his work and life in general. Clay has a great attitude towards work, and he seems to be so much better than I am at just enjoying the process and not worrying too much. So, with all that said, enough of me talking, and let's get to my conversation with the wonderful Clay Hixon. Clay, I'm really happy that we can finally chat. I've been really looking forward to this chat.
Thanks. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about with you, because you not only do commission illustration work, but you also have a small publishing printing house, Tan and Loose, and you also have a monthly newsletter publication. I don't know what you call it, but called The Smudge.
Yeah,
so you're quite a busy person. But for now, I'd like to start by asking you how you usually describe what you do to people outside the creative arena when they ask you, like, what do you do, Clay? Kind of.
I usually just say that I do illustration work, and then sort of like try and gauge their reaction to that to see if they actually want to know more or if they just want to leave it at that. I usually get a lot of like, oh, that's so old-fashioned sounding.
You know? Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd usually say you're an illustrator?
Yeah, I generally describe myself as an illustrator.
And do you ever mention The Smudge and Tan and Loose, or you tend not to mention that with people outside the creative world?
Depending on how interested people seem, I'll say, like, we also have, you know, some small publishing projects that we do. But, you know, I usually don't get too deep into it unless they really care.
Yeah. Would you say that, like, most of your income comes from from commission work, or is it more split?
I think it's more split. I don't know exactly, but I think it's probably pretty close to like 50-50 between commission work and then, the publishing stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool. And that's pretty atypical. I mean, it's interesting because illustrators have a lot of other side gigs usually. They don't just do commission work. Some of them do, but So how did you start out creatively? Like, were you drawing as a kid, or were you always kind of, I see you on Instagram posting, you know, a lot of sketches, and you seem to really enjoy drawing legitimately. Not every illustrator likes actually drawing, is what I found out, which is interesting, but you seem to really enjoy that process. So was it always like that for you?
No, not at all. I actually didn't really get, I was never too interested in drawing until a little later in life. I mean, like, I got into like graffiti in high school. My older brother was into it, and so I just sort of like, you know, followed him around and got into whatever he was into. So that was when I started drawing, but I was also doing a lot of photography in high school, and that's actually like when I first went to art school, I went for photography, but then quickly got
studying
into
photography.
And I started to take other classes and kind of lost interest in photography.
Yeah. So you weren't constantly like the kind of kid who's like drawing and just.
No. My dad is an illustrator.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. He was like not working so much anymore, but he was a airbrush illustrator in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Yeah.
Super cool. I do Photoshop airbrushing.
Yeah. So that's I was looking through your work.
That's interesting.
Yeah, you know.
So your dad did it the real old school way with an actual airbrush?
Yeah, he's definitely like, you know, one of the airbrush masters, California That's airbrush masters.
Crazy. Yeah, it's actually like crazy difficult to use an actual airbrush. It's something it's just a craft. It's
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. Like at one point I thought, you know, I would try and pick it up. And I like, now I truly appreciate how much work and how difficult it is.
Did he ever kind of share that with you? Did he teach you like a few tricks or?
Yeah. I mean, I would ask him for advice, but I never got deep enough really. You know, I remember like watching him as a kid, watching him work, because he worked out of the house. Mostly he had a studio in the house. So it was around and he would let us mess around with the airbrush, but didn't really truly appreciate it till I tried for myself. And I just don't have the patience.
Yeah. So you never actually, you don't airbrush yourself?
No.
No.
Okay. I did for, you know, like a year or two, just casually. Yeah. But
I guess the equipment is also kind of expensive. That's one of like the I mean, yeah, it's not that expensive, but you do have to invest some money into
totally the actual equipment. And he gave me some of his, so I didn't have to it was, you know,
yeah, that's cool,
low risk.
Wow, yeah, that's really interesting. So you did have a kind of a role model that was doing you know, that was getting paid doing creative kind of illustration work,
really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and my mom was an art therapist, so
wow, okay. So yeah, there like was a really lot of creative, like, family. Yeah,
yeah, there was a lot of, you know, just sort of like crafting.
Yeah,
she would, you know, just like collaging or like a lot of like just playing with glue guns and stuff, you know.
So were you quite confident in your ability to really, you know, make a living out of something creative? Or
no, not at all. I'm okay. Still not that confident in it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I never really planned on doing illustration work at all.
Uh-huh. But you thought you were going to be a photographer, so did you foresee making money with that at the time when you went to art school, or
honestly, I don't know. I was always like pretty unsure of what mm-hmm. the future would look like.
Yeah.
I was just sort of, you know, following my interests.
Yeah.
Not thinking too far in advance.
So not super confident when you went to art school, not like totally sure what you were going to do. And when you were there, where did you go to school, by the way? I don't think I asked you.
I went to the Art Institute in Chicago.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. You're so in Chicago, right?
Yeah. I live in Chicago. Yeah. Cool. The Art Institute is a great school. So you went in there and you were like a photography major then? Or
yeah, you don't have to declare majors.
Okay.
So I, you know, was focusing on photography for the first, I think only for like the first semester. And then I was also taking some printmaking classes.
Yeah.
And just was way more interested in printmaking. So I pretty quickly just transitioned to that.
Yeah. What was it about printmaking that really got you hooked?
I don't know. There's something, I mean, I generally like process driven mediums.
Yeah. Just
find it like it helps to like organize my thoughts in that way, like having mm-hmm. to figure out how to produce an image.
Mm-hmm. You worry less about the big picture and you focus on the process. Mm-hmm. It's kind of really helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
there's something about physical, I guess, with you, it seems that you're very attracted to things that where you can create something physical, at least looking at your work.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely, I do a lot of digital work.
Right. Yeah.
But I still have like really kind of romantic opinions of physical pieces, you know.
And you really like risographs. I think you kind of like, did you fall in love with that while at the Art Institute, or was that later?
It was later.
Okay.
I had never heard of them, I don't think, while I was in school.
Oh, were they teaching you more like screen printing and... When you say printmaking,
I was doing kind of like all the different print mediums. You know, etching and lithography and screen printing.
Yeah, okay. So the more classical kind of traditional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And by the end, I was doing pretty exclusively screen printing.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, is kind of like the closest thing to risograph printing.
Yeah.
Process-wise.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a natural transition.
So did you graduate kind of thinking I'm going to be an illustrator, or?
No, not at all. So I graduated.
And what were your plans at that time?
I have no plans, really. I graduated and my girlfriend at the time was living in Montreal.
Uh-huh.
So I graduated and then like immediately moved to Canada.
Yeah. And, so you were thinking Chicago's not cold enough.
Anyway. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I actually moved to Montreal like in, I think it was like January.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's rough. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, couldn't work. I was there illegally. Like I didn't get a visa or anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I couldn't really work and I didn't really know anybody except for my girlfriend, and she was in school. So I just like had a lot of time, and mm-hmm. it was the middle of winter, so
so you're stuck inside. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of when I started drawing more, because I suddenly didn't have access to a print studio.
Uh-huh. And did you immediately kind of feel like that was the direction you wanted to take, or was it kind of like you were just going with it?
Yeah, just going with it. I've never planned too far in advance with anything, you know.
Well, there's planning and there's also just worrying constantly. Because for myself, I just, if I'm doing something, I'm always asking myself, like, what am I doing? It's just like a constant existential crisis. So yeah. I don't know. I always wonder if other people go through that in the same way or not.
Yeah. Really. I feel like fortunate that I also don't worry too much.
Okay.
Yeah. I try and just like enjoy the ride, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been lucky, like things have generally worked out pretty well. So that also
they
helps
have, yeah.
not
I mean,
to
you
worry.
You do have some really big projects that you've been, it seems like constantly like kind of like driving yourself with. So I think that might have helped you as well, you know?
Yeah. I think it definitely helps with the worry.
Yeah.
Just like being fortunate enough to work on things that I never imagined I would have the opportunity to do.
Yeah. So you were drawing for yourself, and how did that evolve? Did you like start kind of like putting it out there? Or?
Yeah, I had a Tumblr at the time, mm-hmm. and started just doing like a weekly drawing that I would post,
uh-huh.
just as a, you know, way to like maintain some sort of schedule.
Yeah.
Were
there particular subjects or topics you were like drawing, or just
those
just,
ones? Not really, no. But they were all digital. Like when I was in school, I was really like rebelling against digital work, and I wanted everything to be done by hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I got out of school and started to think that that was stupid, and like, you know, the computer is just another tool, and mm-hmm. we can take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
So this Tumblr that I was doing was, I think it was like strictly digital. Like that was the experiment, like just making digital work.
Digital, like with Photoshop? With the,
mm-hmm.
yeah?
Yeah, yeah, just okay. Photoshop.
Yeah.
And
did you kind of start to think about your style, or not really, just keep going with the flow?
Just keep going with the flow, but I was also, I was spending a lot of time at the library, the public library, uh-huh. and felt like I was just sort of like researching like my influences a little deeper than
right, yeah.
than just sort of like scrolling through the internet, which is what I
yeah, yeah.
had and still do.
Yeah, and I was talking, I don't remember who I was talking to about this, but it there seems to be more anxiety when you scroll the internet and look for inspiration in some way, for me too, and for other people, where like if you open a book, it doesn't have the same effect on you, where you're like comparing yourself or
totally. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know what that is, but there's definitely a level of anxiety
that the internet just like makes you feel incapable of doing anything or like,
yeah totally.
Yeah, so what was some of the stuff that you were looking into at the time?
At that time, I was, you know, sort of like everybody else, was like getting super into like the Memphis, 80s Memphis design stuff, you know, which like
was a big trend. At some
yeah,
point.
Had a real moment, and
uh-huh.
you know, still is still
yeah,
seeing the effects
strong,
of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, just looking into a lot of that stuff, and
your aesthetic seems to have a lot of like 70s kind of like underground, and maybe also like, I don't know, like it, maybe Milton Glaser kind of mm-hmm. stuff in it. Were those some of the people you were looking at as well, or
not so much at that time? But yeah, I think like all that Memphis stuff, or that 80s stuff, led me, you know, like to the things that I now like feel a much deeper connection to than I did about that stuff.
Like, maybe I can still see that in your colors. Mm-hmm. Definitely like the very bold shapes. Mm-hmm. You can still see the influences of the Memphis design. And so were you getting any jobs or looking for commissions at the time or no?
That's when I started getting illustration jobs. I never tried to get them, but at that point, Bloomberg was doing their website. They were like getting illustrators.
Like Business Week or?
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was a time where they started doing a redesign and they eventually became more focused on illustration in the magazine. Maybe that was around that time. I don't know.
Yeah, there was Bloomberg's website at the time was just like hiring a lot of illustrators. Mm-hmm. And those, they gave me like my first illustration jobs.
Had they just seen your work on Tumblr? Or
yeah.
Were you on Instagram as well or?
No, this was, I mean, I don't know if it was before Instagram or if I just didn't have Instagram.
Or if it was before Instagram was big.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was only using Tumblr and they had seen my work on there, I think.
Cool. And so what was your first job?
Oh man, I did such a horrible job. it's like the most embarrassing thing I've ever done.
That's okay.
I'm trying to remember what the story was. It was something about like
so it was an editorial illustration kind of thing? Or?
Yeah. And those jobs for that website were really intense, at least seeming to me at the time, having never done any work like that. But you know, they would email you at like 10 a.m. And ask you if you wanted to take the job. They would just sort of like give you a general idea of what the story was. Mm-hmm. And after you agreed, they would send you the story and say, like, we need sketches by 2 and a finished by 5, you know?
Yeah, that's rough. That's, like, pretty tight deadlines.
Yeah, and I was, like, I had no confidence in my work. Uh-huh. And my process was sort of, like, all over the place. So it's just sort of, like, had no idea where to even begin. Uh-huh. And I would just read these articles that either I didn't understand, like some of the later ones were like political stories from countries that I had no context for, And so I would just read them over and over again and just try and pick out like any little nugget of something that I felt like I could illustrate. And they're just like some of the worst work I've ever done, but I'm so grateful.
You got a few of these, it sounds like. They came back.
Yeah, they came back a few times, and I was so grateful that they did. Because I really learned a lot doing those jobs. And
like, learned a lot about the process, like the editorial process? Mm-hmm.
Just like working with an art director and, you know, sort of like knowing the limits, like my limits, and how to work within like a tight deadline, you know, stuff like that. But the jobs paid really well. And so that was when I first started thinking like, oh, this is like a kind of like a viable career, you know?
So did you kind of foresee getting more editorial clients? Did you start to reach out at that point or no?
No, I've never really reached out.
That sounds nice. I think also maybe what it might be is that you sound like you're patient. And so maybe, because I don't know if reaching out even works per se, but sometimes when you're impatient, it feels, at least it gives you the feeling that you're doing something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
You sound like you might not be as impatient as I am, for example.
I think I'm pretty patient when it comes to that work. I mean, part of it is just that I don't want to illustrate full time. Like, it's not like I still get really stressed out with illustration jobs. It's just like,
why do you think that is? Like,
I think it's just like a lack of confidence in my abilities. Like, I still think I have a lot of gaps in my illustration abilities.
Okay.
And so a lot of my time illustrating is spent like trying to work around my own.
I understand that. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, I know that I can't draw that. Mm-hmm. So now I have to figure out how to get around it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have some insecurities about that still. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So at the time you kind of thought, oh, that this is a viable path, but, you still weren't super confident in it.
Yeah. And I've always had day jobs, you know, so there wasn't like a lot of pressure for money. Like I was always making enough money to just sort of like live. And then these illustration jobs at the time just felt like a sweet bonus.
Yeah. Yeah. but I guess you can get restless in those jobs or at least I speak from experience, like sometimes those day jobs are unfulfilling. It could be hard to just keep going because you feel like you want to be illustrating all the time.
Right? For sure. Yeah. I always tried to like make a point of finding jobs that weren't super draining. Like when I got home, I felt like I could still pursue my own
What
interests.
Kind of jobs did you do over the years?
A lot of them were just like coffee shops, a couple like retail jobs. For a few years, I worked at a library, and that was like the best job I ever had.
Really? I've worked at a library, but I hated it.
Maybe really?
It was a different type of job. I was barcoding things in the back, in the front. Yeah.
In Chicago?
Yeah, at the University of Chicago.
Mm.
But that felt horrible. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe you had a more front-facing job.
Yeah, I did. I was working at the Ryerson Library, which is the library in the Art Institute's in the museum.
Yeah.
So it's like the museum's research library.
Uh-huh.
So it's just art books and art and architecture.
Cool.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it was like very casual work environment. And like spent a lot of time just like perusing the shelves.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get to even go to the shelves. I was doing like more of the data side. I guess.
Yeah.
Like it's not that fun, or at least I didn't have fun with it.
A little more grueling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then I know you like started Tan and Loose around the time that you graduated. So was that around the same time that you were drawing, posting on Tumblr, doing those jobs for
It was a little bit later. I graduated in 2010, moved to Canada for just like a year and a half, and I moved back to Chicago. I guess it was in 2011, and that's when I started to discover Rizzo printing. I had just started seeing the prints online. Like, there was a couple publishers in the UK that were using them that I really loved.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about the process, but I found a Rizzo printer on Craigslist. So I just went for it.
Oh, yeah? They're quite expensive sometimes, actually, the big ones at least.
Yeah, it was definitely like the most expensive thing I had ever bought at the time. And
you just took a chance because you had never printed with Rizzo, right?
Yeah, I had never printed on it. I had a general sense of what it did and how it worked, but I don't know if I had even ever like held a Rizzo print. I had just seen pictures of them.
So you took a huge risk on this.
Yeah. I remember calling my dad and telling him, I was like, I think I'm going to go buy this thing. I was like, what do you think? And my dad's a big, he's sort of like a big collector. He, like, we always grew up going to the flea market every week and going to garage sales. And so he was just like, yeah, go for it. He was like, I can justify buying anything. So
yeah,
just do it.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I mean,
did you get a Rizzo risograph printer that had the inks already, or like, because you have to buy inks that are like quite hard to find in America?
Yeah, so you
too.
Have to buy the drums.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one came with 6 drums.
Oh, that's a great deal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. And it was
because some of the inks are like not legal in America, I think, or like.
I don't know about that, but some of them are hard to find.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's all getting easier now. like at that point, it like the Rizzo explosion like hadn't quite happened yet.
Yeah,
at least that I was aware of. Like I knew of a handful of printers around the U.S. and Canada and the U.K.
Yeah, and now in Chicago we have a there's a press that does. I'm blanking on the name, but
yeah, there's a bunch in Chicago that's perfectly acceptable.
That's the one I'm talking about. Yeah, I'm thinking about. Yeah,
Matt. Yeah,
he's
great.
I took a workshop with him on Rizzo, actually at a co-op. I forget the name of that too. I'm so bad. Sputnik. Yeah. Yeah. So, were you talking to those people? I don't know if he had his press yet.
He had it, but he wasn't in Chicago yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember when he moved to Chicago. But when I got mine, there was, I think maybe two other guys with Rizzo printers, and one of them happened to live like two blocks away from me. Like I just found him online and he lived two blocks away. So I just walked over to his house and.
How did you find him?
Well, there is this. I don't know if this is how I found him or if I just sort of Googled Rizzo printers in Chicago, but there's this pretty vast network of Rizzo printers. There's like a Google group called the Church of Rizology. And now there's
people
like a Slack
Google
channel.
Groups? I didn't know that.
they don't use it so much anymore. Now there's Slack and like Facebook groups.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time, that Google group was like
so
all
it's like
I
people
knew about.
Like it's kind of like Reddit, people sharing knowledge and just like
just go on and you know because those machines break down all the time. So
you
would just be like, hey, I'm getting this error code. Anybody have any advice?
Yeah.
And it was super helpful. And also, like, made a lot of friends that way.
Yeah. So did you start experimenting with the machine? Like, were you up and running pretty fast, or did it take a really long time for you to actually understand how it worked and all that stuff?
Yeah,
because it's
pretty,
kind of finicky.
They're finicky, but they're pretty straightforward.
Right,
so,
yeah.
And you know, I had a printmaking background, so I understood like at least how to design for it. You know, how to set up an image.
Can you explain that briefly for people who are not familiar with Rizzo, like how it works?
Sure, yeah. It's pretty similar to a screen print in terms of image setup. So you have all your colors on separate layers.
Yeah.
And you print them one layer at a time. So
And the machine makes a master, right?
It makes a master, which is essentially a stencil. Mm-hmm. So you upload your image to the machine, and it burns a stencil into this like tracing paper material.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wraps the stencil around this drum.
Yeah, which is quite unique for a printer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're pretty crazy looking.
Yeah. Because it just literally will wrap around the drum.
Yeah.
It's so weird. And the drum is pretty big.
Yeah, the drum itself, it looks like an 80s like sci-fi movie bomb.
Yeah, 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 it does. You're right. Yeah. It just looks like nothing you should ever handle.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty funny.
Yeah.
But, so it wraps your stencil around the drum, and then it pushes ink out.
Mm-hmm.
Through the stencil onto the paper as it feeds through.
Yeah.
And so each drum is a different color. So you'll put in your red drum, print your red layer, and then switch out the drum, put in the blue drum, feed your paper back through and print the blue layer, and build your image up that way.
Yeah. Were you attracted at all to Rizzo, you think, because of the colors? Because they tend to, it comes out as like very usually vibrant kind of like colors. It has a certain quality to it too that's very distinct. You can tell when something is Rizzo printed.
Totally. The colors, you know, like the Rizzo fluorescent pink is kind of like the signature Rizzo color.
Yeah.
And I had seen pictures of that. At the time, I was also just like super into really bright fluorescent like screen print colors.
Mm-hmm.
So that was definitely attractive. And I love the quality of them because the quality is pretty wonky. Like they're not, they're yeah. very imperfect. The registration jumps around a lot and the ink coverage can be pretty uneven. And they're just not, they're not fine art printing.
Yeah. It's like and the ink never like fully like sinks in. It's like sitting on top of the paper, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always, it like never feels like it's totally dry. So it's always like a little smudgy.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's why you called your newsletter the smudge.
Yeah, exactly. that was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So once you had the machine, is that when the idea came about for Tan and Loose? Like you thought, oh, like, I don't know. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So at first I just was messing around with it, like printing my own stuff, you know, printing like posters for friends.
Yeah.
And, some like little zines of my own. And then I wanted to like work with other artists, and so I planned this print show, which was like based on a print show that I had seen these other UK publishers doing, just sort of like get a handful of artists to design a Rizzo print and then I would print them and just host a little show
in Chicago.
And so that's when it first, that's when it kind of like officially became a press.
And I think your partner was part of that whole move, right?
Liana was at that point not so much.
Okay. So she got involved more towards when you had the idea for the smudge, or is that
No, but in between, like she, like over the years has kind of like become more and more integrated into the Tan and Loose stuff. And like now I would say she was like full on partner in it. But it was definitely like just a project I was doing on my own at the time, at the beginning. And it wasn't very defined. It was just sort of like a casual, like just trying to stay busy. And like have an excuse to work with artists that I liked. So I just emailed like 10 of my favorite artists at the time, artists and illustrators, and asked them if they wanted to design a print. And everybody agreed.
And did you have plans for selling the prints and stuff at that time, or?
Yeah, I think so. I think I probably made a website at that point, and the deal was like we would just split the editions and I would sell my half, something like at the opening. And then the artists could sell their halves like through their own channels.
Cool. And so did you at the time think that this stuff was also going to be helpful with your income, or was that not really?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really ever think that this would become a source of income at all.
Yeah, because I mean, being an independent press, like the costs, I mean, maybe less so the cost because of the Rizzo, because Rizzo is a little bit cheaper in terms of printing, but it can feel like there's a lot of competition, and definitely it's not an easy kind of sphere to break into.
Yeah, I feel pretty lucky that I got into it when I did, because it did feel like a much smaller community.
Yeah.
And
I think now it's absolutely like exploded. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. And I still wouldn't call it like super competitive. But at the time,
well, it kind of depends what your end game is, because if you're not in it to really make a huge profit, then I mean, it gets less competitive.
Yeah, totally. And I also, we don't do any print jobs. We don't print for other people.
Okay.
So a lot of people are relying on those jobs for their income.
Why did you make the decision not to do that?
I did it for a little while, and it's just, it's so much work. And the Rizzo, at least at that point, people weren't as familiar with the process and maybe, you know, just didn't quite know what they were getting into.
Like, so you had to do a lot of like adapting people's projects.
And just a lot of disclaimers, you know, because these prints are not going to be perfect. And
Yeah.
Some people know that and like that, and some people are really disappointed when they find that out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So at a certain point, I just decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. Just like, it was always a lot of work for very little money, and we still will print, you know, do favors for friends and things, like small scale stuff, but we don't take on any big print projects anymore.
Have you expanded like the number of machines you have, or is it just the same that you have the same machine that
still running on that same machine?
Oh, cool.
Been very lucky. It definitely feels like it's on its last leg, but
yeah, because so, they can kind of break really easily, right?
Yeah, things are always breaking on it, and so far I've been lucky that I've been able to fix them myself, or like someone's been able to walk me through it.
So the smudge, how did that come into play? Well, first of all, what is it? Like, how do you describe it usually?
The smudge is a monthly, we call it a newspaper.
Uh-huh.
But
I've seen it being called a newsletter, so I thought maybe you called it that. But
yeah. I mean, newspaper is definitely a little generous, because
I don't think so.
I mean, it's pretty small.
It is, yeah.
It's 12 pages, and
but I think the fact that you have like a classified section and all these different sections makes it more like a newspaper.
I'd say we have all the elements of a newspaper except news.
Yeah. So what's the content usually like for people who don't know?
So it's pretty all over the place. When we started it, right after the 2016 election, when there was just sort of like a general feeling of despair in the world, at least in America.
Yeah.
And we had been wanting to do, me and Liana, my wife, had been wanting to do some sort of periodical. And we didn't really, we just never could figure out quite what it would be. And then...
Was it because you felt like you needed an outlet at the time, or...
We just both like mail, you know, like getting mail and sending mail. And our friend Pete Gamlin, who you interviewed, he was sending out this newsletter. Maybe talked about it in your interview. I don't remember.
No, I don't think he did.
It was called Zugzwang. Or Zugzwang. I don't know how you pronounce it. But it was just a one page, like Xerox sheet.
Wow. And, okay. I didn't ask him about that. That's so cool.
Yeah. He was just sending them out to a few friends, and him and Liana had connected online and became friends. And so he started sending it to us. And it was just like, it was really inspiring to me. It's just very kind of like absurd, just like weird little things that he would fit in, like just
so cool. I had no idea he was this involved in the beginning, actually.
I credit him with being one of the main inspirations for the smudge, and
that's awesome. Yeah,
from the beginning,
probably
because
he's humble, he didn't mention it.
And I remember like sort of consulting with him when we were starting it. He was like, he was in Chicago, I think, when we were like first talking about doing it, just visiting. And I remember like running ideas by him and trying to come up with a name and stuff.
And of course, he's a regular contributor now to the
So anyway, so Liana and I had been wanting to do some sort of monthly. And after the election, it all just sort of like came into focus a little bit. We had also been looking at a lot of, you know, underground publications from the 60s and the 70s.
Like, do you have names of ones that you were looking at? Or?
International Times and the Chicago Seed and other scenes. These were a lot of the things that I discovered when I was working at the library, because they had some of these in their collection. So I was just getting really into that. Like the design of those papers.
Was there kind of a mission behind the smudge, or was there not really that at the time?
Yeah, there was a loose mission, basically just to like create a space for people to express like their anger or just
or anything
general,
they wanted to. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, general emotions about what was going on.
Uh-huh.
So we try and keep it at least vaguely political still.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try and focus on like social issues.
As far as producing it, like, did you already have a kind of an idea of having it be kind of like produced by all these different creatives or not really?
Yeah, well, we knew that we couldn't fill the space ourselves.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
We had no background in doing anything like this other than the print part of it, print and like distribution. Uh-huh. We had those aspects of it like locked down. So that kind of allowed us to do this was that we didn't have to figure out any of the logistics. We just had to like put it together.
Yeah.
Get content, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So from the beginning, the first year of it, it was even shorter. It mm-hmm. was just 2 11 by 17 sheets folded in half.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just 8 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked a handful of our friends if they wanted to be regular contributors. So
and Pete, did people come up with like the sections ideas, or was that you guys, Sienna and you?
Yeah, both. Some people pitched ideas to us. Uh-huh. Some people we like approached for specific things.
Yeah.
Because
it feels very like, to me, it feels very personal, the whole paper. It seems like people really are having fun with it.
Yeah, we try and like let people stretch out a little bit, you know? Like we don't give people very much guidance or feedback. we don't ask for a lot of edits, mostly because we pay people very little.
Yeah.
Like we pay our regular contributors, but all the like guest contributors, we don't pay them anything. They do it for free, and we give them like a free subscription to the paper.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which you know, we don't feel great about. We wish we could pay everybody, but yeah, it's just not in the budget.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah.
We're always really grateful when people understand that and agree to do it anyways.
Uh-huh. It's kind of fun because now you get to play kind of like, I guess, art director in a way, although I don't mm-hmm. know that you would describe yourself as such, but and maybe also editor. Has that really kind of like changed the way that you work at all in your commission work, or not really?
It's a good question. I don't know if it's had much of an impact, only because I would say we edit and art direct pretty lightly, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that's not something most art directors pride themselves on.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I would not describe myself as an art director.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I'm allowed to call myself that.
Are you responsible for all the like type and stuff that's in the smudge? Because it seems like you at least have you pay a lot of attention to that, maybe more than a lot of illustrators.
Yeah, Liana and I do all of that stuff together.
Uh-huh.
And I do a lot of the type design.
Yeah.
Which has been great. You know,
how did you get into that? Is that something that where you like just enjoy drawing type, or
kind of? Yeah, I mean, I guess originally through graffiti, I was like mm-hmm. kind of into type. But for a long time, I wasn't really paying much attention to it, and I never took any typography classes. So all of this is pretty new and like experimental for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
I think it's definitely a way of looking at type that just isn't, you know, maybe formal, or, you know, all the rules of typography are really something else altogether, I think, than just, drawing type is like a totally different approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It produces really cool results too. It's just very different. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know any of the rules of typography, so...
Yeah, but your type work is actually, it's really good. Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, like, I'm always impressed with the way that you draw type, I think, is just definitely really cool.
Cool, thank you.
Do you find yourself like hunting for like old types? Because a lot of your illustrations of type seem very like 70s kind of type.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you draw your inspiration from? Or
yeah, I definitely pull a lot of those typefaces like from those old publications, from like those underground presses.
And I think they were even drawing their own type. Usually they weren't really using ready-made type, right?
Yeah, that, well, there was a lot of hand-drawn type and then just a lot of like hand-set type.
Yeah,
so,
like collage,
and that's the stuff
almost,
yeah. That's the stuff I really love. Like, you know, there's a lot of cases where you can see when they were actually trying to make it perfect, but because it's done by hand, and I'm like assuming a lot of them weren't trained in this,
mm-hmm.
there's just like a subtle wonkiness to it.
Yeah, yeah, which is very appealing, I think.
Yeah, I love it. I just think it like, it just kind of like makes it come alive a little bit.
Do you know how those older publications, like how they tended to print at the time?
I think most of them, you know, just like some offset shop. I don't know the details really, but
yeah.
There's a few pretty famous print shops. Like there was one in San Francisco that a lot of those newspapers printed at. I don't know if it was like somebody just happened to have an offset press, or if they just found a cheap shop, you know?
Have you been surprised with the kind of the readership of the Smudge and the demand that there is for it? Because definitely like within the creative world and the illustration world, like it's a quite well-known publication. People get really excited about it. Has that surprised you at all, or?
Yeah, completely. I mean, we were like pretty shocked by the initial response to it. And I think part of it was
like
just
right
the
away,
timing.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like in that moment, I don't know. I think people were just like
excited to have a forum and
yeah. And also, maybe, you know, we don't have much of an internet presence with it. Like it's not available digitally at all.
Right. Yeah.
It's really like planted in print. And, I think after that election was like people really starting to understand the dangers of the digital world.
Yeah. Some people just disconnected.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I think that also like helped our exposure.
I could see that. Yeah.
We also got a lot, like, I think there was some confusion about what it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
I think people were expecting it to be a much more substantial magazine.
Yeah.
So like the first year we had the most subscribers, and it's gone down a little since then.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was mostly because people just like took a chance on it, which is great, you know?
Yeah,
and then maybe it wasn't exactly what they had in mind.
Yeah. I mean, how much does a subscription cost? Like,
right now they are $65 for the year.
Okay. And that's like monthly, right? Or
yeah, so that's 12 issues.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really cool. I found the Smudge at there's a place in Pilsen in Chicago that sells it.
Pilsen Community Books.
Yeah. I love that bookstore. So
yeah.
Yeah. I always see it there.
Yeah, we were living in Pilsen when we started it, when we started the Smudge.
Yeah.
And we used to go to that bookstore all the time. They had kind of just opened up. We just got friendly with the owners, and so they started carrying it.
Yeah, yeah. So do you know how many readers you have based on, I guess, your subscription numbers, but also like you do have it at a few bookstores like that?
Yeah. I don't have exact numbers, but I think we're around 600 subscriptions.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like makes it feel worth it for us, you know,
because
we don't want to commit to doing this monthly thing if it's for like 12 people, you know.
How much work do you think you spend? I mean, how much time do you spend on producing the paper every month, I guess?
It's gotten a lot more streamlined just as we've like learned and
Yeah, I bet the first issues you were like, yeah.
I would say like the first year and a half pretty chaotic.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot of like planning ahead, I imagine, for like something like that, that just you have to get used to.
Yeah. And we should definitely be planning more ahead than we do. Still.
Yeah. You'll always feel like that though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think like it's gotten more streamlined, but also we've gotten more relaxed about it and just have more trust that it will come together and just be whatever it is. I think we've like been able to sort of manage people's expectations of it to the point where we can kind of throw anything we want at them and they'll sort of accept it and not complain. Like a couple months ago, we did a whole issue in Spanish. And nobody complained, but you know, if you subscribe to something and then you get an issue that's in a different language that you don't speak, you know, I would imagine some people might have been a little bummed.
Did you choose to do an issue entirely in Spanish?
It just kind of felt like a cool thing to do. I mean, there's like such a huge Hispanic population in the U.S.
yeah.
And
I was wondering if it had anything to do with all the news about all the immigration stuff we've been getting recently.
Yeah. It was definitely a little bit of a reaction to that. Just like an acknowledgement that the population is changing and we shouldn't just expect 100% assimilation from immigrants from these other cultures. Like it should be a two-way street, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, neither of us speak Spanish, so honestly, I don't even know.
So you
know
relied
what...
on a lot of contributors, really, to do that.
Yeah, we asked a friend, an illustrator in Mexico City, to work with us on it. So she kind of co-edited it.
Okay. What's her name?
Rachel Levitt.
Okay.
Yeah, she's done some big illustrations. She lived in New York for a long time, and then she moved back to Mexico City.
Okay.
A couple years ago, and she's a great illustrator.
Oh, so you let her kind of like spearhead that whole issue?
Yeah, we just asked her. So the way the Smudge usually works is we have our regular contributors, and then we usually find like two or three
guests.
Guests to like write the main articles or, you know, do the main.
Who are your regular contributors right now? Is it Peter Gamlin is one of them?
Yeah, Peter Gamlin, Rachel Howe, Nathaniel Russell, Gabe Alcala,
you're scared of forgetting someone.
Yeah, okay, hold on. This part we're gonna have to edit.
That's totally understandable though.
Our friend Moira O'Neill.
Uh-huh.
Or she goes by Moira Quinn, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And then we've had a couple that sort of like come in and out. Like for the first 2 years, William Lewes, who's a British artist, was a regular contributor. And now he just sort of like drops in every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
We have our friend Colleen Hammond does our crossword puzzles.
Yeah, those are really cool.
Yeah, we've gotten a great response to the crossword puzzles.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. It's really cool.
Yeah. I think those are... Oh, and Vinny Newberg. He's I think, maybe the most recent regular.
Yeah.
He does like his version of a New Yorker comic for every issue.
That's really cool. And, of course, you contribute illustrations as well. Right.
Yeah, I kind of just fill space. Like I do a lot of the type design and layout, and then any spaces, like weird little spaces that are left.
I mean, you've done some of the covers, right?
I've done a cover. Yeah, once a year. I'll do one, and Liana will usually do one once a year too.
It's kind of interesting that do you kind of like stop yourself from putting too much of yourself in there, or no?
I mean, I would be uncomfortable if it felt like it was a lot of me.
Yeah. It was just like self-serving.
But also at the same time, I completely see this project as like
it's a personal project.
And also like it is definitely acts as like promotional for me and Liana,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
in terms of, you know, freelance work.
Yeah, that's interesting. You have a lot of people that come to you saying, you know, like I love the smudge, or I've seen the smudge and I really like it. Like, do they come to you with that kind of, do you get clients really like coming,
mm-hmm,
to you?
Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten a bunch of work because of it.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, that was not the goal to begin with, but
no, yeah,
it's worked out that way. Uh-huh. And, I like it. I like having it as a space. I think a lot of our contributors like it just as a space, to get as experimental as they want.
Mm, yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's hard to find that kind of space nowadays.
Yeah.
That has an audience, you know, mm-hmm, like you can make your stuff and put it online or something, but this is like a place that's in print where you have complete freedom.
Yeah. I think that's a really awesome way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just been, at least for me, it's been super beneficial in that way.
Yeah. And it sounds like also you don't put too much pressure on the artist to fulfill kind of your vision.
I mean, we just generally look for people that we think fit in, and then we let them do their thing.
Interesting. And as far as writers, I guess you get writers to write the actual content too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, finding writers has definitely been the biggest challenge, just because, you know, our network is mostly visual artists. But it's gotten easier, you know. We've like, some people have found us and have become sort of regular contributors, you know. They'll just, when once in a while, they'll have a piece that they've written that they think would fit, and they'll send it our way, which is great.
That is cool.
Just met a lot of writers through this that I've been able to like build a relationship with.
So I want to talk more about your work, because I really like your work. I want to know more about all the commission work you do, because you've been pretty prolific. You've had clients like Netflix, Portmento, American Express, and more. But I've seen you mention this several places, but you kind of maintain that you don't have just one distinctive style. And I was wondering, like, what are your thoughts about that, about style and your illustration work? Because that's sort of interesting to me. I do see a kind of distinctive style in your work.
I mean, I think there's some through lines, just because it's me doing it, and like, you know, there's always going to be evidence of that.
But do you think that maybe your thing about not having one distinctive style, that's just you don't want to be stuck in one thing, or?
It's not so much that I don't want to be, it's just that I get tired of things, you know? Like, I really admire people that are sort of like locked into a specific style and do it really well and can adapt it to, mm-hmm, you know, different, mm-hmm, projects.
Yeah.
And I've just never been able to do that. So it's not something that I am, you know, like actively trying to like challenge myself to like change things up. It just sort of happens.
Mm-hmm.
As I get interested in different things, you know,
There are definitely like trends in your work.
For a long time I was making, trying to do like super airbrushy looking things in Photoshop, because I was looking at a lot of airbrush illustration and that was inspiring, you know? And, then I just sort of like got into other stuff, and then that started to influence me. I really just kind of like, I really wear my influences on my sleeve, you know? I see things and I just want to do those things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think a lot of creative people can relate to that. But when you get clients, do they usually reference something that you've done in the past and they want something similar, or like what usually happens with that?
Yeah, a lot of times people will have examples of things that I've done that they liked. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't give me examples, and then I'll do something that they don't like at all, you know? And then I'll be like, why don't you give me some examples of stuff that you've seen?
Yeah. Do you tend to market yourself as more of a commercial illustrator or editorial? Do you not even think about those things, really?
Yeah, I don't think about the distinctions too much. I mean, for me, it's all kind of the same. It's like work and personal work, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the lines can get a little blurred, but like the usage of the illustration for me isn't so much of a factor, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. What's one of your projects that you're really proud of, that you really enjoyed working on?
The Appartamento cookbook is definitely like one of my favorite projects I've ever worked on.
Yeah. Why is that?
I feel so fortunate to have gotten to do it. I mean, Appartamento was like my favorite mm-hmm. magazine, still is kind of like the only magazine that I read every issue of, you know?
It's beautiful. Yeah.
So beautiful. And I had loved it for a really long time. And so it's just like so excited when they contacted me, and then to have the opportunity to to illustrate the entire cookbook, mm-hmm. like just such a amazing project to get to work on. Like it just sort of checked all the boxes of things that I love to draw and am inspired by, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you know why they picked you for this project?
Not really, no. I mean, I'm trying to remember how it even came about. I think they had worked with other artists that, you know, I'm like peripherally affiliated with in mm-hmm. ways, you know? So I think they just sort of like came across my work through other artists.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, I guess when you look up people like Peter Gamlin, I guess you kind of come up too. As a kind of in the periphery, which is kind mm-hmm. of an interesting aspect of collaborating with all these people.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of credit that with like my whole career, like starting with the Tan and Loose stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I would do a print show and...
And yeah, you have all these other names associated. It really definitely
helps. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so suddenly like, all of their audiences are kind of checking you out, you know, uh-huh. and it just, it's like exponential exposure, you know?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which
of course
is amazing.
It takes like more putting yourself out there and reaching out to people, mm-hmm. which can be kind of scary.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like always afraid of being turned down or just like denied, you know, and it happens, but people are nice about it. I try and maintain like a pretty human level of interaction with uh-huh. people. You know, I don't ever get too businessy.
Or just utilitarian, just network for network. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I try and like make it casual and fun.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, you've gained some real friendships out of it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I made a lot of like some of my closest friends are people that met just through these projects.
Yeah. The Netflix project you did for Easy,
mm-hmm.
How did that come about? Because I was sort of interested how they, because they seem to be commissioning more artists at Netflix, particularly like for particular series and promotions. But yeah, I was interested in asking you that.
Yeah, that one was pretty serendipitous. The director and creator of that show, Easy, Joe mm-hmm. Swanberg. He lives in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And he's like a real, I think he's just like really committed to Chicago
uh-huh.
and Chicago artists and uh-huh. filmmakers. Like that show Easy takes place in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I don't remember initially how we connected. He wanted me to, I think, do a poster for a different movie he had been working on.
Uh-huh.
Just like, I think it was just sort of like a side project that he had been doing.
Uh-huh.
And we met one day, just like got coffee and kind of hit it off. Just like had a lot of the same interests and opinions. And then he got that Netflix show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, he wanted a different artist for each episode just to do the title card.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was just like pretty soon after we had met. So he asked me to do one. And then he also asked Liana to do one.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So cool.
Yeah. I had no idea he picked Chicago people really for that. But that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I think all of them have been Chicago artists.
Mm. Yeah.
Pretty sure. Yeah.
That must have been quite cool to see your stuff on screen like that.
Yeah, totally. Really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you got to do some type too, which seems to be one of your the things that you really enjoy.
Yeah. And it was definitely like in my early days of sort of exploring type. So I think it was just like I used Cooper, which is sort of like the easiest
mm-hmm.
go-to typeface to like have sort of a 70s feel, you know?
Yeah.
Not that I don't love it, but.
Yeah. So how do you usually, you mentioned books earlier, but how do you get inspired now? Where do you draw inspiration from usually?
Still mostly books. Both Liana and I are like pretty serious collectors of of books.
Of mostly art books or?
Yeah, mostly art books and magazines.
Uh-huh.
Been buying a lot of old magazines.
Like what kind of magazines?
One that has been a huge influence for the Smudge.
Mm-hmm.
We've been buying old issues of Pushpin Graphic.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which, you know about it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so it's I don't think it was monthly, but it was a regular magazine that Pushpin Studios would put mm-hmm. out. They did it for like 30 years.
Mm-hmm. How do you find those?
Just mostly on eBay.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I decided I wanted to collect all of them.
Uh-huh.
Because they're so Pushpin Studios was a graphic design studio run by Milton Glaser and Seymour Quast
mm-hmm.
and a host of other amazing illustrators.
Yeah.
And so this was just like a promotional magazine that they would put out. And it has the same sort of like experimental qualities that we try and do with the Smudge.
Mm-hmm.
There'll just be like random little bits and like inserts and things. And the format is always changing. And
that's so cool. Yeah. Are they easy to get those? I mean, I bet there's not a lot of them, but
the later ones are easy to find.
Uh-huh.
You can find them pretty cheap, but the early ones
are rarer.
They started in the '50s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is crazy to think about. And they're, you know, they're printed on like brittle newsprint.
I bet
know?
There wasn't a lot of them to begin with.
Yeah, I don't know what the runs were like.
Yeah.
So some of the old ones are hard to find, and I found a few, but currently trying to collect all those, and we have a good amount of them.
Mm.
So those are pretty inspirational. Also like Avant-Garde magazine.
Yeah.
It's another big one. Yeah, usually we'll just, you know, as we like find out about new artists, we just try and find books by them
uh-huh.
or about them, and we've amassed a nice little library.
Yeah, are there books that you have that are kind of like favorites of you to draw inspiration from?
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to think of some specific ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at a lot of those illustrators like Seymour Quast and John Alcorn.
I don't have a good Seymour Quast book that I've tried to find books that have a good collection of his work. And
he's got, some of his Some of the books about him are not great, but there's one called The Left-Handed Designer that's a pretty great little...
Yeah, I think I've seen that on Amazon, recommended to me. Yeah,
it's a pretty good overview of his career.
Yeah. Do you have the latest Milton Glaser poster book, the one... Because I know he released a collection of his of all his posters in the book.
Yeah, I do. It's great.
Really? Yeah. I was looking into that too.
Yeah. I mean, it's small, which I don't love. But it's like exactly the kind of book that I want. It's just like the left page is the image and like the right page is what it, like a description of the project, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like hundreds and hundreds.
There's like 400, I think, which to me seems great.
Yeah, it's like, that's all I want. I really just want like a catalog of everything these people have ever done, you know?
Yeah. Do you have other recommendations for books?
Just
interested like, because I also feed my own habit of collecting books.
Yeah, totally. I'm just like scanning the bookshelf now. Oh, man. I don't know. We've also, we buy a lot of like architecture books. Always been super into.
Me too, yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm just like endlessly chasing this dream of buying a house that will just like never happen. But I like to just dream about it and look through these books of beautiful architecture. Saul Steinberg is like always super inspirational just to flip through those books.
I wanted to ask you, because we're almost out of time, but one question that I always ask people is if they could give young artists or illustrators one piece of advice, what would it be?
I guess it would just be to like stay as busy as possible.
Oh yeah, that's kind of interesting,
you know?
Yeah.
Like there's, at least in my experience, with freelance, there's going to be times, like very slow times. You know, where you're not getting any work. And I think it's really important to just like create your own projects to fill those gaps and like maintain momentum, because it's much harder to work like starting from zero. You know, when the jobs do come in, it's nice to just like have momentum. Or
do you have a routine, like on, like do you work every day no matter what? Or
yeah, I mean, we work every day mostly because we love to work. And like working every day doesn't necessarily mean that we're getting a lot done.
But do you have kind of like time that you always wake up and stuff, or do you try to keep like a pretty regular kind of like routine, or no?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I generally wake up pretty early, and I am usually like pretty excited to start working.
Yeah.
So, I say we because me and my wife work together.
Yeah.
Like we work at the same table next to each other every day.
Yeah.
So our routines are pretty much one. And so we, you know, we just like get up early, have breakfast, and then just start working.
Oh yeah, that's my dream. eventually, I think I'll be able to do it, but we'll see.
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you're in a couple with somebody creative, that's kind of like what you dream about, I feel.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it definitely does not work for everybody.
Yeah.
It works for us, and it's great. But also, you know, I hear a lot of like, if you're going to be working from home, you really have to like be strict about your work hour, you know, treat it like a job. And I think there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
But also not everybody works well in the morning, you know?
Yeah, no, I can personally attest to that. I'm not a good morning person. I've never been like that. Like when you describe the thing where like you wake up and you're excited to start working, that's not me.
Yeah. And that's
I start
cool.
to get excited around like, maybe like 11 or like 11 a.m.
Yeah.
Like it just, I rev up pretty slowly. Like it's not, it's not like 8 and I'm like up and at 'em. But I know people who are like that, and that's just a different temperament.
I, I think it's mostly just important to like to be in the workspace at the times that you know are your like optimal times, you know?
Yeah.
Some people work all night and like that's cool if that's how you do it.
I don't do that either, but yeah.
No, I can't do that. I love the idea of that.
Yeah.
Staying up late.
It's like romantic. Working. Yeah.
Yeah. But I get tired.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Yeah. It's. Do you have a space that you've kind of like made your workspace, or is it just work out of your apartment? Or?
Yeah, we work out of our apartment. We just have a second bedroom that we use as a studio.
Okay. Yeah. And you use that as a printing
No, we have our print setup is it's in my aunt's garage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah,
which is amazing. Like when we were in Chicago, nice. We had it in the apartment with us.
It takes a lot of space because is your machine pretty big? Because most of them are, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's like the size of a full on copy machine.
Yeah,
like from Kinko's.
I think some of them are smaller, although I've never seen a smaller one, but.
There's they're all pretty big.
Yeah. Yeah. Having that in your apartment is definitely not great.
Yeah. And then, when you're doing a print project, like you realize pretty quickly that you do need space just to like set down paper,
Yeah.
So I feel really fortunate that we have space outside of the apartment for all those things.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I don't want to take too much of your time, but do you have time for a few rapid fire questions to end the?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So do you have a favorite pen that you draw with?
Yes. I use a Lamy Safari.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that because I've seen it on your Instagram and I actually use those too. I love them.
You do?
Yeah. I'm French and in school in France, we use a lot of fountain pens. I mean, we learn to write with fountain pens as kids. Mm, so
cool. The
Lamy one, the Safari one, is actually one of the ones that is most used in French schools because it's really ergonomic and you can write pretty well with it. I know a lot of kids had that.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So I had like a few. I had like one for red ink, one for black ink or something. And I still have them. And I love them.
Yeah, they're great.
They write,
I
don't know. They're so like smooth and really comfortable to use. I don't know why, but.
Yeah, I love this pen. Mostly I like love the idea of having like a signature pen, you know?
Yeah. Do you use the ink, the water, or the ink that comes with it, or do you like use your own like?
I don't know. Actually, Liana is in charge of ink buying generally, so I just kind of use what she gives me.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you use cartridges or a converter or something? Or?
I have a refillable one.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the inks that it comes with are not waterproof. That's the only thing. Like. You need to have your
That's good to know because that's actually something I just recently was like, I gotta find some waterproof.
But you totally can. You just have to fill it yourself with waterproof ink. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So the Lamy Safari. Do you have a medium nib or like a
fin? Yes, medium.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and what's your favorite thing to draw?
I find that I get, it changes, but I kind of like get sort of just like hooked on certain things that I'll just draw over and over again for months and then slowly like move on to something else.
You saw you draw a lot of food, it seems like.
Yeah, I love drawing food. I like drawing furniture.
Yeah, yeah.
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 I say cool. Mostly food and furniture.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any good resources for learning risograph printing? Because I know some people might have an interest in that.
Yeah. I mean, I think now it's like pretty easy to find in most big cities. Like somebody is running a riso press.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Oftentimes they offer classes.
Yeah.
The process is pretty straightforward, pretty easy to grasp. Like you could probably ask somebody if you could just come watch for an afternoon and get a pretty good idea of it.
I mean, the biggest hurdle is what machine you're actually going to use, because most people don't have their own. So I guess you have to go to a press. But it's true. Yeah. Like I'd second that. Like there's a lot of good presses running workshops and stuff now.
Yeah, and there's a website, Stencil Wiki.
Oh.
Which is like just a Rezo resource that our friend George Weider designed. He runs Issue Press in Grand Rapids.
Uh-huh.
And it's a really amazing resource for like all things Rezo. There's he made a atlas of Rezography.
Uh-huh.
Basically, it's just like a map with all the Rezo shops in the world.
That's cool. Okay.
All the ones that have, you know, submitted their information.
Oh, but, yeah, that's perfect. I'll put it in the show notes. What are your favorite movies or favorite movie, if you have one?
Man, that's a good question. I love movies. Okay, well, some of my classic favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana Jones.
Uh-huh.
I'll lump them all, the first three together, but the first Indiana Jones, truly.
Uh-huh.
I grew up with, like, you know, like Wayne's World and Austin Powers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those movies definitely, like, had a big influence. More current movies. Oh, I really love 20th Century Women.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Rewatched it recently. And,
I haven't
and
seen
like,
that, I don't think, yeah.
It's really great. I mean, it, you know, I love it because it takes place during a time that I'm really interested in, like, a part of the world that I'm really interested in.
Uh-huh.
It's like California in the 70s.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Late 70s. But it's a really great movie.
Cool.
Highly recommend it. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you already talked about this a little bit, but artists that inspire you, past or current. You mentioned Seymour Quast, Milton Glaser.
Yeah, yeah. Those guys were, you know, those are pretty big names.
Classic, yeah.
I mean, this is like a little bit cliche, but like all of the artists that we work with on these projects, like the Smudge and the people that we publish with Tana Luce, they're like my favorite artists, you know.
Yeah,
that's like why we work with them, is because we really love their work.
Mm-hmm.
So Pete, Nathaniel Russell, Gabe Alcala, Anna Heifisch, somebody who I've loved for a really long time.
Oh, okay, cool.
German comic book artist, yeah.
That's what
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could name a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know the pressure of naming everybody that you admire. It's kind of like, yeah.
It's kind of like I'm like being on stage accepting an award, like trying to remember who to thank.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I haven't mentioned you.
It's not because you don't.
I still love your work.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
What's your favorite thing to do in LA since you... live in LA now?
We're very much homebodies.
So
we spend most of our time here, but when we go out, you know, we love to go eat. There's so much amazing food.
Yeah.
Like there's incredible food in Chicago, but I think maybe just like at that time in my life, I wasn't super interested in it, or just like financially wasn't feasible.
No,
you know?
There's definitely a lot. Yeah, the food scene here is good. But it's really good in LA too.
Yeah. So we love food. Just hanging with friends mostly.
Yeah.
It's nice to be... The other thing about Chicago that we didn't really realize when we were there was just that we didn't have a car, and so we were really like just in the city for the 10 years that we were there.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And being out here where we, A, have a car, and B, are super close to, like, really incredible landscapes.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've been...
Which neighborhood do you live in LA? That's...
Koreatown.
Okay, yeah.
So kind of, like, right in the middle
yeah.
of the city.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can drive an hour and be at the beach. Or like an hour and be in the mountains or the desert. Yeah. So just like been doing a lot more of that, which feels really good. Just little road trips and getting away from the computer for a little while.
Yeah. And California is beautiful.
Yeah. I grew up here, so it's nice to.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. I grew up in Northern California.
Cool. Okay. Well, Clay, thanks so much for your time and for being on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And that was my conversation with Clay Hixon. Remember, you can find the show notes for this episode on our website at illustrationhour.com/Hixon. And please, if you like the podcast, remember to share it with your friends and leave us a review or rating on iTunes. It really helps the podcast grow. That's it for this week. Next week, we'll have a very exciting guest as well on the Illustration Hour, the wonderful illustrator Thomas D'Anthony. That's coming up next Monday. But until then, have a good and creative week.